You're listening to Amphibicast.
Welcome back, everyone. Thank you for joining me again. This week, we're going to do an interesting take on amphibian studies, something that I've never done before. I have two filmmakers, and they're out to create a project about a species of salamander that faces some challenges in Panama. And it's going to be an up-and-coming project. We're going to talk about kind of the nuts and bolts in terms of how something like this comes to be, what they're planning on doing, and really what the ultimate outcome is going to be. So it's pretty cool. If you've ever been interested in nature documentaries, and especially if you've ever wanted to know what happens from the very inception before anything gets made, I think this is going to be an enjoyable episode for you. But before that, of course, the usual stuff. Thanks, everybody who supports the show. The Apple Podcasts and the Spotify. Spotify took off. We got over 100 five-star reviews, and I appreciate that. So if you want to support the show, a great way to do so is just leave a nice five-star review on your favorite podcast player. And other than that, any other way you want to support the show, check out the link tree in the show notes. That'll take you to the Patreon page. If you want to become a Patreon, if you want to become a patron, I should say, I've got tiers as low as $1 a month up to the $5 a month tier. And at the $5 a month tier, you get a shout out at the beginning of an upcoming episode. And you'll also find a link to In Situ Ecosystems if you want to purchase a vivarium through them and get a 10% listener discount. Make your purchase through the link in the show description, and bang, you get a discount. So other than that, usual stuff, I got that over quickly. I want to introduce the two of you. I've got Cy Harper, and I've got Aura Manjares, and I want to thank you guys both for reaching out to me and taking interest in the show. How you guys doing? What's going on?
Doing pretty well. Thank you. Thank you so much for having us. We are more than excited to be here.
Yeah, we're doing great. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, so I want to get into the project that you're setting out to take on here, but I was wondering if the two of you, maybe one at a time, each of us, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get into nature? How did you get into the idea of creating a documentary, all that stuff? Kind of for the listeners, kind of tell us a little bit about who you are and how you ended up involved in this kind of project.
Yeah, sure thing. When I was young, I was very sheltered, which is kind of contrary to a lot of the people in herpetology that start out kind of going outside and stuff. But my introduction to herpetology was through watching Steve Irwin when I was little, and by keeping frogs of the genus Hymenocheris. And ever since that, it's just really kind of exploded into its own thing.
Kind of, pretty much also like Cy, I was a very sickly child, so I grew up inside a lot. So for me, I lived the world through the pages of books and magazines and through the screen. And for me, wildlife documentaries were a really, really big thing. And I think that that's what kind of propelled my interest. When I eventually got to attend university, I decided to go for film. And I did that because what I wanted the most was to make wildlife documentaries. So I think that it was serendipity that Cy and I ended up, we started having one conversation, which led to another, and then eventually we realized, like, oh, this is a thing that we both would love to make.
And how did you two, like, what was the moment that the two of you got together and this kind of coalesced as something that you wanted to do together? Like, what was the, what cinched the whole deal for the two of you?
I think that it was over, like, just one conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I was on a long layover, and I think I just messaged Aura and I said, hey, what if we just go for this?
Yeah, because we had been, we had been talking before that back and forth and kind of, giving each other pep talks on the things that we do individually. And I think that one of the biggest motivators for me, that Cy kind of planted into my head was that, that me making wild documentaries was not a lost dream. And I think that for me, something that I tried to, you know, help Sai with a lot and talking him through it was that, you know, even though this topic that we're trying to put out there in this documentary is not researched enough and it's not, you know, big in the herpetology community, it is something that is doable and that he could pioneer. And I guess that we put two and two together and it was kind of like, oh, okay, this thing, once again, is completely doable. We both are in our fields, like we are deeply rooted in our fields, so much so that if we combine our knowledge and our talent and our resources, we could do this.
That's amazing. I mean, you mentioned a couple of influential people before. You mentioned Steve Irwin and whatnot. And one thing that you said did kind of strike me as interesting, that wildlife documentaries are a lost art. And I'll tell you, I mean, I'm much older than you guys. But when I was younger, we had wildlife documentaries were of a different caliber than what you would see today. A lot of the news networks kind of have, I don't say news networks, cable networks or whatnot. They kind of more sensationalize the animals rather than tell a story, mm-hmm. which was what happened a lot in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s. What drew you guys to that style of a more, we'll say, like a classic kind of nature documentary as opposed to stuff that you might see on some of the bigger networks nowadays?
Well, I don't know if I'd necessarily call it classic per se. What we're doing is we're going to try to put a lot of personality into it. So it's not necessarily going to be entirely like really old Attenborough that you'd see. I mean, and that just comes from kind of who we are. We're both very, for lack of a better term, eccentric. And like, I go to the symposiums, I wear leather pants, I wear 6-inch Brazilian platforms. I look more like Motley Crue than I do look like a herpetologist normally. So we're going to put a lot of that into the movie. And a lot of the film isn't just going to be these animals. It's going to be the animals, the people that live around them, working as a community overall, everybody, and above all else, sort of undertones of acceptance within, I hesitate to say academia, but life in general.
Okay, I get it then. I like that angle. I see you kind of want to put like a more, like a very holistic approach to it. I got you.
Yeah, exactly. Because, and we discussed this when we were coming up with this idea, these animals do not exist by themselves in this environment. There is so much around them, so much that affects them, so much that they have influence over also. And it's important for us to touch on every single, here's my approach to this. If we want to truly tell the story of this species, it is important that first and foremost, we make sure that we go to the roots of it all. Hey, this is the place. These are the people. This is the environment. These are the locations. You know, all of that matters. All of that has value and weight and has a voice. And we want to be able to bring attention to all of that, because you can't just go on screen and tell people, hey, these animals are endangered and that's that. But why are they endangered? What happens if we try to help them? Can the community help them? Why can they or why can't they? If they choose not to help them, what is stopping them? You know, all of this is important, because that way you make sure that the message is clear and that it is understood.
I see. Yeah, I know. I think that, I mean, like I said earlier, creating a documentary, obviously you're looking to tell a story, and a story isn't going to exist with a single character. So you're going to mm-hmm. have to bring in supporting characters. And obviously that's mm-hmm. going to be people within the community, other species, the dynamics of everything in the environment, whatnot. Yeah, I get that. I want to hear about some of your initial motivations to making this, kind of going back up a little bit though. And Cy, you had when you had first reached out to me, you mentioned it was a particular species, and you had kind of a backstory in terms of why you wanted to work with this. Tell us about your background and like your inspiration for this project, and tell us about the specific species that you chose to focus on and what inspired you to do that. I think it was started off in Panama, right? You want to walk us through that?
Yeah, for sure. So I don't really remember when I started to fall in love with the genus Spalitoglossa, but I think it honestly was in May of this last year, May 2022, when Boletoglossa cathledaceae was described, and it hit all the publications and all the journals, and everybody got super excited about it. And that's when I started to get really excited about this genus. I told my friends that work in the herpetology department about the zoo about this species, and it had been in the back of my mind for a really long time. But I work on projects with other taxa, and I do research in other areas, so it escaped me after a while, but it always stayed there. Until I had the opportunity to go down to Panama. And that's when, months in advance, I started to read about all of the different species of amphibian within that area. And I rediscovered and refell in love with Boletoglossa and this publication. And I tried to read everything I can. I spent countless hours on phone calls with my friends that have done field work in the Neotropics. And I just did everything I could to try to find out how I can find Boletoglossa in the dry season. And usually you do that by peering through bromeliads and any sort of arboreal cavity. And I was so surefire I would find at least one species of Boletoglossa, even if it was one of the really common and prolific ones. And I go down there, and I don't find anything. And I spend hours and hours and hours peering through plants trying to find these salamanders. And I don't find any. I attribute it to just bad luck. And eventually I make my way to EVAC. You might be familiar with them. They do work with Atalopus zatecki. And I get to talking with the guy in charge of EVAC. And he just tells me all these things about how hard chytrid hit Panama and how Boletoglossa aren't very prolific at all anymore. And they're just in these fragmented little populations within the country where they are secluded from really moving around. And I started talking to other people that live in the area, and I found out that they spray herbicide and just pesticides and stuff up in the cloud forest. And that explained a lot, because when I was in the cloud forest, it was dead quiet. It was like Silent Spring by Rachel Carson in terms of how quiet the cloud forest was. It was ominous. And that really put a lot of fire in my belly to try to help these animals out. And with Boletoglossa cathledaceae, that's the new one. That's the red one that they found in, they described in May. They call it the Chiriqui fire salamander, is a common name. It's beautiful. It looks almost like an arboreal equivalent of the Pseudotriton rubra that we have here in the United States. But they really, the authors of that paper really want that to be on the IUCN critically endangered category. It's not on there yet, but they want it there. And one of the main motivators for this film is getting that species on the list, getting it some protections. Because if we are finding these species just months to years before they go extinct in the wild, then that's a tragedy. And we want to prevent that to the best ability possible.
Give us a little background on the genus, some of the natural history, the threats. And I mean, obviously, we kind of discussed how the documentary is going to benefit the species. But for the listeners who aren't familiar with Boletoglossa, and I actually do have a couple of listeners who are actually quite familiar with them, but it's only like two people. So they're not a particularly well-known genus, and I'm not familiar with many of the species. But give us some information on them. What are they like? Where would you look to find them? What kind of, you know, what kind of diet do they have? Like, what's their life cycle like? Just kind of give us a run through from start to finish in terms of what they are.
I think the easiest way to start is, I'm a huge phylogeny guy. So do you know Hemidactylium? in the United States, the four-toed salamander.
I'm not much of a caudate person, so I'd have to, I know I'm not familiar.
Oh, I got you. So basically the origin of Validoglossa is it was a, it's a lineage that comes from, the United States portion of North America. And eventually this lineage worked its way down, to around the California area, down into Mexico. And that's where you can find a lot of these really cool plethodons that start to look more like Validoglossa. And that's stuff like Ismuria and Otapina and different genera of salamanders like that. And eventually, once you get down to central Mexico and down into Nicaragua, Costa Rica, Panama, that's where you start to see them. And they are incredible. We have arboreal salamanders here in the United States. They're of the genus Aeneides, though, and they're on the totally different side of the lungless salamander family tree. So arboreal behavior in salamanders is something that was convergently evolved over a period of time, which I think is incredibly cool. So you have these Validoglossian salamanders, and they're totally different from any other salamander in the world. They have these incredible webbed feet, and they come in all shapes and sizes. I mean, there are Validoglossian salamanders. Validoglossa delphini, I believe, is the species name. The palm salamander from Guatemala, and it's huge. It's like the size of Dicamptodon. And this is an arboreal species of lungless salamander. They don't follow any of the rules of the other plethodontids, which is something I love about them. And they come in different colors. You have Validoglossa jacksoni, which is this gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous golden species of salamander with a black line running down its back. And you always hear about Nerurgus being the most beautiful genus of caudate. And I love Nerurgus. I keep Kaiser Eye. But Validoglossa is by far, in my very biased opinion, the most beautiful genus of caudate. And the ones that we're looking at, like I said, are Validoglossa cathodaceae. We're going to be looking at some of the less endangered species, and that's stuff like Validoglossa lignicolor as well, because even if they are listed at a least concern level, they still deserve protecting, just like anything else does. We're also going to be looking at Validoglossa magnifica, which is a member of this really interesting group of neotropical salamander, where they're these really large, dark-colored salamanders, and they are really weird because they don't work like the rest of the genus, and they will burrow under logs like Ambystoma tigrinum. And I believe the holotype in the publication that came out when it was discovered mentioned that this was under a log. So they're really weird like that. They live in bromeliads during the dry season, but during the wet season, you can find them commonly on shrubs if you just shine at night on slopes near bodies of water. I believe they're a relatively recent lineage, but most of the salamanders you're going to find in Central and South America are going to be this family, the Validoglossian salamanders. And I believe they stretch all the way out into some pretty far south portions of South America. I believe they're the southernmost species of caudates in the world, this genus.
What about the tongue feature? I know with Validoglossa, I've seen footage of which species it is, but apparently the tongue fires out at like a rate that's, I think it's like the highest of any animal, something like that.
Yeah, they do that. I think that's really interesting. One of the things that I like so much about them in that respect is that they're like if a salamander just tried really, really hard to be a chameleon. Because they do that. And that's actually relatively, I don't know if I'd say common within salamanders. They do it much faster than other salamanders, but you can find salamanders even here in the United States that can fire their tongue like that. And I believe the European ballistic tongue salamanders do something very similar as well. But they do that, and that's what they use to capture prey items. Overall, a lot of their natural history is really understudied, and that kind of comes with the territory. Within a lot of the neotropics, most of the publications and most of the projects done on species are systematics in their distribution. We don't know a lot about the functional morphology of many species of amphibians down there as well as we do up here. So I don't know if that answers that question very well. I kind of feel like I opened a door to a different area, and I apologize for that. But I hope that resolves that in some kind of way.
No, you answered the question perfectly. Like I said, I'm not very familiar with caudates, so any information that people give me, I always appreciate. You're studying the genus, though, right? You're not going to target any specific species. You're just going to kind of go with whatever you can, right?
Yeah, well, we really want Magnifica, and we really want Cathladaceae, and we really want to look at those two. But if, the whole genus is incredibly threatened. They're so fragile, because we know about how fragile the plethodons are here. I mean, take that, and we have a lot of conservation measures here to, keep, say, the Red Hills salamander from going under. In Panama, a lot of the biologists are really frustrated because it's really hard to get funding for conservation. And combine that with how fast chytrid spreads. And I believe there's some anthropogenic stuff at play too, like I said. It's all about just awareness and just collaboration and everything, I think, at the end of the day. But yeah, we want to work with all of the species within the genus if we can, because they all need help. Even if they are least concerned, they need help.
Yeah, Panama is definitely in a difficult position. Yeah, I've had Edgardo Griffith from EVAC. I've actually had him on the show a while back, and he was telling me very similar to what you're telling me about, especially with Atelopus, like chytrid's like right outside the facility. So it's really, really challenging. It's interesting how certain species in Central America can be so common and some can be so like dramatically, under pressure and threatened. Like, how do you expect to find them? Because, from what you told me earlier, you took a trip down to Panama, you didn't find any. What are some of the methods that you're going to employ to find them once you're there?
It's all about collaboration, I think, is the name of the game with this next step. I have some contacts up in the United States now that can give me a little bit more help than what I've been getting. Because a lot of my friends that do work in the Neotropics, they do amazing work, but they're not doing work exclusively with Boletta glossa, and I've been building a network as the months have kind of gone on of people that have published amazing work with these salamanders. And like I said, we really want to get those biologists down there to help us. And if we can get them to help us, then hopefully we can get them to point us to where they are and get some footage of them. And I really, really want to have, if we can, somewhat lengthy interviews with these biologists that are working with them, because they're the real heroes of this story. All we are is we're spreading the word, we're trying to get it out there, but they're doing this incredible work, and they need to be put up on this pedestal of being amazing biologists, because they really are.
That's also an interesting dynamic. You don't often see biologists and whatnot interviewed in documentaries. That's, I've seen it a few times, but I've never really seen something done to the point where it would feature interviews with people. That's interesting. That's a pretty cool take. Aura, I was wondering if you could tell us what drew you to this project and what your role in this is going to be.
Yeah, of course. So before I am anything else, I am a filmmaker, and so basically what I am going to be doing is, I guess, producing and assisting and directing this entire ordeal. I am going to join heads with Sai, and we're going to come up with an outline of, like, okay, this is what we're going to do when we're down in Panama. This is what we have to do before, this is what needs to happen in pre-production, and then this is what needs to happen in post-production. And once we have those steps figured out, I am going to put them in place. I think that what I am contributing to this project is mainly, being able to get the footage, because what I want is to see, and I'm going to talk about somewhat of an adjacent topic for a little bit, but I am doing this project because I think that what Simon is doing is way too noble of a thing. And I believe in it. And again, before I am anything else, I am a filmmaker. And what I have been doing all these years in my filmmaking career is put visions on the screen. I think that's what film is. I think film is an ongoing conversation that you can always come back to. And what I want is to make sure that we have a clear vision of what we need to do once we get down there. And once we know what we need to do, I am going to do anything that needs to be done. I am going to be holding the camera. I am going to be editing footage. I am going to be translating, because we do want to, or at least we touched base on this a little bit. We would like this to be both in English and in Spanish. And I am a Spanish native speaker. So whether it is subtitling, whether it is dubbing, whatever it is, obviously, you know, that is going to happen in post-production. But basically, that's what I'm doing. I am, once again, assisting, producing, and directing.
What are some of the steps in terms of making a film, like for the listeners? Because I don't normally, I don't think I've ever talked about film in detail up until now. You mentioned pre-production, production, post-production. I mean, you don't have to be specific to this particular project, but when you're making a film, what are the steps from start to finish, and how do they normally get executed in the field?
Okay, so you have three categories: pre-production, production, and post-production. What needs to happen and what is happening right now as this project is, coming to life right here in the States, is pre-production, which is we're trying to figure out, okay, how do we get the funding? Who are the people that we need to either get down there or, you know, be able to sit down with for a little bit, whether that is through Zoom or on the phone or whatever it is? What kind of equipment do we need? Who can we contact to be able to help us with the technical process of making this film? And then you have production, which is actually going down there, finding the spots where we could find these animals, setting up, making sure that we have everything that we need, that everything is working, that our devices and our tools work with the environment that we're going to be filming in, and then actually filming and actually, you know, going on these little, for lack of a better word, adventures to, you know, doing field work and trying to find these animals and, like, okay, getting footage of them. And if we're not able to get footage, you know, talking to the locals, hey, have you seen? Hey, have you heard? Hey, what do you know? And then you have post-production, in which, you know, you're always doing post-production. Like, even when you're doing production, you're always doing post-production, which is like whatever footage you have, you edit. Whatever is not working, whatever didn't work during production, you see how you can fix, or if you need to do reshoot, you reshoot. Coming back home and making sure that, you know, we have venues to show this documentary at. And if we don't have venues, okay, what platforms would be willing to stream this for us? And, you know, so those are the basic steps of making a film, basically to condense everything. In pre-production, you need to make a list and you need to pack your bags and you need to make sure that, you know, for this kind of project, for example, that you have the funds in your pocket. And then for production, you have to go down to the country where you need to be. You have to get to the specific places in whatever kind of environment so that, you know, you find your target species. You need to be able to have the people that are going to help you with either the technical side of it, or that you're going to interview, or that are going to help you do the field work. You need to have them at ready, and you need to be able to tell them, okay, this is what we're doing, and then you do it. And then post-production, you pack everything up and, you know, you work with what you have. And if something needs to be fixed, you fix it. And if it can't, so sorry, and you move on.
No, I know post-production. I do it with the show, and I know exactly what you mean. If something goes wrong, uh-huh. there's only so much you can do. What kind of what kind of timetable are you looking at for a film? Well, let me back that up. Now, you're looking to create, obviously, a full film. Are you looking for something that's going to be an hour, 2 hours? Like, what's the finished product? Like, what's the goal? How much footage do you want to get for, I guess, for a viewing experience?
Honestly, as much as we can get away with. Because we are currently trying to, secure the funding through our GoFundMe and everything. We're working with limited resources here. We are not, we're not people that are working with National Geographic or for Discovery. And this is something that to me is very present. I currently am the host of a film festival in the state of Maryland. And this is something that I get, it's clear in my vision, that you kind of have to look at your tools and be like, okay, you know what? I am going to do whatever I can and get away with however much I can get away with. For something that is so limited like this, I think it's always healthiest to like, however disorganized this sounds, I think it's always healthiest to be like, okay, I am going to work until I exhaust my resources, because I don't know what my budget is going to be as of now. And until I know that, I can't put a cap on things. And you kind of just have to, you have to wait it out. That's one of the things that, that's one of the answers that doesn't come to you until it's time to cross that bridge,
Now here's a question that you're a filmmaker, so it's probably going to be a straightforward question to you, but why film? Why not an article in a newspaper or something like that, or a book? How is film going to benefit this cause as opposed to a different type of media?
We are all different types of learners, and film brings together all of the different learning types. We have visuals, we have audio, we have, on the screen, it's going to be textual also. Film is, it is an experience that you live through. When you listen to a song, sure, you're listening to it and you're living through it. You're feeling it. And it's intense. When you're reading a book, it's the same thing. It's in your mind and you can feel it and you can live it and you can breathe it. But what if you can read it and you can listen to it and you can see it? Like I said earlier, film is a conversation that you can keep coming back to and that you are actively part of. And I think that it is personally, and this is a completely biased opinion, but personally, it is the most powerful way that you can actually get a point across. It is the most powerful way that you can deliver a message, because there's no way that people are going to, there's no way that people are going to be able to ignore what you're trying to say.
And if there was, I'm trying to think of a good way to phrase this. If there was a template, like if you could set your filmmaking or for this project, like if there was a template or something that you wanted to aspire to, can you give us what are you looking to create in comparison to say like other types of documentaries? Like what's the bar that you've set for yourself in terms of the project?
As a filmmaker, that is a very good question. My answer might be a little disappointing, and I don't mean to sound cliche or quirky or not like the other girls, but I don't like comparing my work to other people's. I don't think it's fair for me or for the other creators. But if I personally had to, pick and choose, and obviously, Sai might have a different vision than I do, but I'm trying to do something like Jeremy Wade with River Monsters. I'm trying to be like, hey, we're going to go here and we're going to look for them. And we're going to look for them until we can't look for them anymore. And while we're looking for them, we're going to have people from the area come and talk. And we're going to have people that, you know, they are brilliant minds in this field come and talk. And if we find it, great. And if we don't, that's great also, because it means that, you know, this and this and this might be happening, or that we're just not looking well enough. And if we have the opportunity, we'll come back and look for it again. But we are going to make sure that while we're looking for it, we are giving you every bit of information that we can, so that you are also informed, so that you are also part of the experience, so that you are also inspired to research.
I like that. I think I don't think that's a cliche answer at all. Honestly, I think that that's a pretty great answer. I'm thinking of like different types of documentaries, and I've thought about it where it's not even so much like a documentary about the animal itself. It's almost like a documentary about finding the animal. Like, there was a movie in the 80s about Diane Fossey. It was called Gorillas in the Mist. And the movie was, it wasn't a documentary. It was a dramatic film, but it wasn't really so much about the gorillas. It was about Diane Fossey and the character that she was and her experiences and the presences. So it didn't necessarily focus on gorillas. It focused on the person involved in working with them and protecting them. Mm-hmm. And I could definitely see how that type of experience where you involve local people and you involve scientists and experts. I'm definitely getting a good picture in terms of what you guys are looking to accomplish. Si, what's your take on this? Like, what are you looking to accomplish through film as a media for your project?
Oh, I loved the Jeremy Wade comparison, like in terms of this project, I had a giggle because I really think that is what we're trying to do, because Jeremy Wade had such a sense of humanity about him and the way that he does everything. And I think that is really a lot of what we're trying to do. I mean, like, you know, everybody's trying to be like Planet Earth, and Planet Earth's wonderful. I love Planet Earth. But like Aura said, like we are just doing our own thing, you know, and nothing's going to stop us. It's this journey that we're very excited to be making with, you know, this genus of salamander. And I guess your question was like goals with the project, right?
Yeah, if there was a standard or something that you were looking to attain, like a bar that you were going to set for yourself for the project, what would it be?
I think that the bar I want to set with this project is I want this project to reach the highest amount of people possible in the animal field, out of the animal field, everywhere. And I want them to get inspired about something that they never knew that they would be inspired about. And I want them to, I want them to laugh. I want them to just feel at ease. And I don't want this to be, River Monsters is the best comparison. It's so casual. It's in terms of, it's human. Steve Irwin was like that, you know, like he very human. And that's what I love. I don't want people to feel like I'm a herpetological researcher. You know, I'm putting out work. I don't want people to feel like there is this very uptight, stereotypical academia person on screen. I want them to laugh when if we get like footage of me falling down in mud, you know, I want them to laugh at that. And I want people to cry when, you know, like, and be very passionate, just feel very heartfelt with everything. That's my bar. I want this to be the experience of nature. I want this to be the experience of people. I want this to be the experience of everything and how we're all interconnected and, you know, why you need to shoot for the stars with everything, because nothing is unattainable. And with wildlife conservation, we can save every single one of these salamanders, I think. As long as we put our minds to it and we all work together, we can do it. I think we can.
And when are you two looking to start? Now, well, actually, let me back up a second. I know you have a videographer. I know he couldn't be here with us tonight because he had a different commitment, but I mean, it's going to be the two of you, your videographer, and like how many other people are going to have to get involved in this from the production angle for it to come to fruition?
So we have been talking about it, and we would still like to involve at least one more person. Again, through participating before hosting and now hosting the film festival, I know that small crews can get so much done, like so much done. And if you have the right people that have been, you know, working in the industry and have been doing this for a while, it is going to be laborious, but it could be self-sufficient, and it is absolutely doable. So we would like to have at least three people doing stuff behind the scenes and running the show behind the screen. We are still trying to secure the funding, and you know, if it depends on when we would be able to reach our goal and whether we would be able to get any other type of help other than our GoFundMe, and that would determine whether we are able to involve more people or not. But I am 100% sure that even though it would be hard, man, I'm telling you, it's going to be hard out there, but it is doable. Three people can do it. And obviously, you know, Sai.
And which one of you is going to take the realm or take the reins as host, or are you guys going to share that role?
Sai would be doing that. And that's why I would like to have, you know, myself and two other people that are, you know, great at what they do, running the show behind the screen, so that we are able to provide Sai with as smooth as an experience as we can, so that he can do his thing. And so that, you know, we really are able to merge kind of both areas of expertise and get the ball rolling.
Now, do the two of you have a tentative plan? Like, let's just say, for argument's sake, let's just say that you had funding today. What kind of timetable would it take to get everything in motion, secure a location where you're going to be, film, do post? Like, if someone were to give you, say, I don't know, say like $1 million tomorrow, how long would it take the project to get done, and what steps would you go through for this specific one for that to be accomplished?
We were saying that if we were able to secure funding, we wanted to go down there around like towards the end of May, the beginning of June, right, Sai?
Yeah, and you know, the tough thing is right now is we are just getting running right now. So the biggest challenge we have is you know, trying to get people to believe in the project and, you know, get us the funding and everything like that. And it's very grassroots right now. Like, we have the GoFundMe, and I am so grateful for everyone that has put everything into that. We're both so grateful for that. And I've been putting every dollar I've been getting through my research. Because I get paid with my Salamander research here in the Midwest, I've been putting that into savings for this project. Because right now it's truly just a labor of passion for getting out there and conserving these things. But yeah, if we got the money today, we need I think we need about $11,000 more dollars is what we need to get down there. If we got that money right now, I would just coordinate with everybody, and we would you know, get some contact set up down there and get down there as soon as possible. But if we can't do that, and obviously that's very pie in the sky, and that would be wonderful, and nothing is impossible, but my contingency plan, if that does not happen, is I'm going down to the Biology of Plethodontid Salamanders conference in Louisiana, and I want to try to get as much advice as I possibly can about this genus, because there's going to be multiple Blitoglossa researchers at this conference, and just try to figure out everything I can. So basically, I guess what I'm getting at is, if we can get all the money, that's awesome. And we will all coordinate, and we will rock this show as soon as possible. But if we can't do that, then we're going to build our muscles and we are going to just do what we can while we can and making sure it's just all smooth sailing.
And as far as the actual production itself, like when you're in the field, what are some of the challenges that you expect along the way? Because I know, I mean, for example, even in a controlled environment, like my frogs, when I try to get a decent photograph of one of my frogs, it's under highly controlled situation, but they don't always want to cooperate. And it can take, you know, many, many, many efforts to get the shot that I want or whatnot. What are some of the challenges of dealing with a species that's very, very rare and very elusive? Like, how do you plan to deal with things like the weather or, you know, issues with equipment or having difficulty finding them? Like, what are some challenges that you know right off the bat you're going to have to overcome while you're in the field doing the film?
Oh, my God. Like you were just saying, even with people that willingly cooperate, it is so hard sometimes to get the right shot, to capture the right, you know, to capture good audio, to get the lighting working right, making sure that your batteries are charged. Like, all of that is always such an issue, and it is nobody's fault. That's just, you know, sometimes that just happens and you kind of have to roll with it. So obviously, technical issues aside, I think that obviously, you know, there's always the possibility that we go down there and we find nothing. And even though that wouldn't be, or I personally wouldn't call it a problem or an issue, because again, we're trying to do what we can. And this isn't a real world problem more than it is an emotional problem, but just like the feeling of defeat that all of this happened and we put ourselves through this. That would be one, other than, again, technical issues.
Well, I mean, I don't think that not finding one would necessarily even be the end of the world. I watched a 2-hour long documentary about the thylacine, and the last official sighting was in 1933. I mean, I still watched the whole documentary because I found the subject to be very, very interesting. And when you get something that's very, very charismatic, I feel like you could get away with it, even if you didn't necessarily find one or the one that you were looking for.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, after all, that's kind of what put us on this journey, just how, you know, enigmatic and rare and how not well they're doing in general. I mean, I guess the bonus, though, of the fact that they are very, you know, the flip side is they're rare, but they're really slow, you know. And it's not like we're doing something with cobras where, like, you know, one wrong move and that's a hospital visit. These are very gentle animals. And not that cobras aren't, you know, gentle in their own right if you treat them with respect, but I find it, as the person that's going to be probably most hands-on with these animals and, closest to them in terms of the filmography setting, I find it very comforting that, you know, it's going to be easygoing. You know, they're salamanders and they move pretty slowly, which is quite ideal.
And what would be the perfect outcome of this, like, for the film? Like, if everything were to go perfectly according to plan and you were able to locate the species that you wanted and tell the story that you wanted, I mean, just for me and the listeners, just kind of give us a walkthrough of how this would play out in your head if there was no major hiccups and no obstacles. Like, how would you want this to, from the beginning of the film to the middle to the end, what would the process be for the viewer?
I think that the structuring of the film depends a lot on, it's a lot of brainstorming. It is a lot of brainstorming. And obviously, you know, you can make an outline like, okay, we're going to introduce Sai, and then we're going to introduce the, you know, this place in Panama that we're going to, and then we're going to introduce the people that are going to be helping us on the science communication side of it. And then we're going to get a bunch of footage of being out on the field. And then we're going, like, that is so easy to come up with, but it takes so much brainstorming to actually come up with the storyboard of this. And a lot of things change, honestly, during production and in post, once you're stitching everything together, a lot of things change. So again, I can sit here and tell you, this is how we're going to structure it. But in the end, it might not look like that at all. And it all depends on, like we were talking, on the issues that we encounter along the way, because again, some things you kind of have to work around or work with or work against. So this is a very, very basic knowledge of film, is that you can storyboard, but the end product is most likely not going to look like that. But everything starts with an introduction, you know? So it's either, you know, directly introducing Sai once we're down there and introducing the place that we're in, or, you know, even adding footage from, hey, we're at the airport and this is so cool. Or even before being at the airport, like, hey, my name is Sai and I researched these animals and we're going to go here and this is what we're going to do, you know? So it would really depend on, okay, we have everything we need. Let's plan things out and then let's start doing them. And if they are not working out as we planned them, now that we had everything on the ground, then what can we do, you know? So.
And what about equipment? I know your videographer, he couldn't be here with us, but if either of you can kind of comment on like what type of equipment you're looking to go into this project with in terms of like what types of cameras and microphones and how does, you know, getting all that stuff into the field work from a logistical way? Because, I mean, I know from having, you know, my microphones and whatnot, I have it in a controlled environment. It's not raining on me. It's not, I don't have wind or anything like that blowing. So I'm assuming you guys would need some very specific equipment for the field. Can you, either of you, just give us an idea of what you might use and how it would be effective?
Yeah, so I was talking with Justin about this recently, and he told me that, because he works with a company that's called Planet Indonesia, so he's out in the rainforest quite often, and he is often filming with these very compact cameras, and they have very good macro lenses on them and stuff like that. And he has these specialized like bags for his cameras to make sure that, like, even though we're going to be in these really humid environments, they're not going to fog up. And I mean, that's just a huge bonus about working with these really small placid animals. And like, we're not going to be out for instance, the Serengeti, where we would need huge cameras with huge lenses in order to get the shot that we needed of these animals. Everything can be, I hesitate to use the term micro scale, but it's going to be very intimate, all of it. And you know, we're not going to hesitate to be very close up with everything. And in terms of equipment, it's not going to be anything insane, I guess is what I'm getting at, in terms of how much we're bringing down there.
Aura, what's your take on the equipment as a filmmaker?
This is going to be my first experience doing something like this. What I am used to is very, how could I put it, commercial. I am used to working with people indoors more than I am used to working with little guys in the big outside. So this is new territory to me, in terms of like actual technical work, which I am very excited about. But Justin would definitely be the expert here because he is the one that has, you know, done work like this before.
I see. Yeah, I'm always curious because I know that anything outside of a controlled situation can always be so difficult. Mm-hmm. But those are just some of the most amazing shots that you can get. So If everything goes according to plan and the film is completed, how are you looking to I mean, I don't want to say market it into the, you know, like it's, I don't want to be dismissive of this in terms of making it into a product, but how do you intend to, you know, sell this and get this out to an audience that's going to be able to see this? Like what's the goal to get this accessible to people to watch?
Yeah. So that's stuff we've talked about before in terms of just, you know, trying to get it into as many languages as possible. It could escape me, but I don't believe we've fully put into stone how we're going to be distributing it and how we are going to be actually putting it in front of people. But something we have kind of talked about is potentially using this film not only as this standalone product, but also having it as a sort of, I hesitate to use the term pilot, but pilot, because we've talked about doing other projects. You know, if this works out very well and we can get people very excited, then very cool if we send this out. We send this out to Netflix, we send this out to Nat Geo, we send this out to Animal Planet, we send this out to Discovery, Disney Plus, everything. Just short of, you know, throwing darts at the board, trying to, you know, get the message of conservation out there. And of course, we're going to be, we have our budget right now that we are generating for filmography, but we are going to have to, along the line as well, generate a budget for an impact fund to try to, you know, get this in front of people.
So just to put my foot in the door with this one, because I am like well connected in the film scene here in Maryland where I live, I do have a couple of people lined up to, once this gets done, put it out there in local movie nights, in local theaters, in film festivals here in the state, and potentially, you know, being able to send it out to other festivals. Most film festivals charge a fee, and if we eventually do have a fund, you know, to market this film, that's great. But at least here in the state of Maryland, I have had conversations with some people and, you know, try to sell the idea to them. And I have gotten quite a lot of interest, to be honest, because you don't, like we were talking in the beginning, wildlife documentaries are a lost art. And there's not really a lot of it being shown. Not in the underground scene, not in the underground film scene, but also not in the mainstream local film scene, like at all. So it definitely perked up a bunch of ears and like, oh, what are you trying to do? Oh, okay. When is this? Oh no, you're just getting it started. You're just getting it off the ground. And can you talk to me about like how you're getting funding? Oh, okay. Let me share this around. So it definitely, we will be able to, you know, at least put it out there. And if it takes off, it will take off.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I don't think people really fully grasp about any kind of product, that's whether it's video, film, audio, whatever, is that there's a tremendous amount of effort that goes into that that doesn't always come easy. And mm-hmm. when you are passionate about a particular project, regardless of what it is, there's so much that goes into producing that relatively small amount of content as opposed to the hours and days or years of work that goes into it. I mean, I give you guys a lot of credit for taking on, you know, such a big project.
Thank you so much. And I mean, honestly, that's stuff that we've kind of, we decided not to put this on a direct timeline kind of for that reason. We have kind of an idea of when we'd like to, you know, get everything out. But both of us are very busy a lot of the time with stuff. And while this is a huge, 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 incredible project, you know, some of it is very daunting, and there's only so many things that a person can do within 24 hours every day. So that's one of the reasons why we have kind of chosen to put this on a little bit of a relaxed schedule in terms of getting stuff. But once we have everything together, it's go time. And we are incredibly excited about it.
Well, I want to ask you guys, I have one last question that I want to ask you guys, and it's kind of more of a subjective question, but it's really for each of you. So, Sai, I'll start with you. If this works out, or if it works out, or if it doesn't work out, what would you choose to do from here on in? Would you choose to go back to research, or would you choose to pursue becoming a wildlife documentary presenter? Like, which of those career paths would you choose depending on, you know, whatever the outcome of this was?
I don't think that it's mutually exclusive. And I think that that's a big part of my personality and why I'm so excited about this. At the forefront of everything with my personality, I'm a rock and roller. And while my music career is on a hiatus right now, I don't feel that I have to be mutually exclusive between being a rock personality or being a scientist. And, you know, and same with this. We're going to bring all this in here. And I don't believe that there is, for me at least, and how I see this project, there is no plan B. There is plan A. And plan A that I am willing to put every fiber in my being into making sure that this is a success that reaches as many people as possible, moves people, makes people want to get excited about wildlife conservation and all that. This is going to work out in my eyes is how I see it. But if, you know, in a hypothetical world, it doesn't, nothing's going to stop any of my drive for wildlife conservation or any of it. It's all still going to happen. I still want to do research. Research never stops. I have 11 research projects I'm working on right now. This is on that too. And I'm going to keep doing all of it for the rest of my life until I'm not able to do any of it anymore.
And Aura, similar vein, but slightly different. Your passion is film. If all goes according to plan with this documentary, or not, do you want to continue to pursue film as in general, meaning any film that strikes your fancy that you think is a good project, or do you want to focus on wildlife documentaries if you had a choice?
I want to dip my spoon into every and all the different types of soups that I can. I have never shied away from a project. And I don't think I ever will. This is what I live for. This is what I have invested so much time and so much love and so much energy into. Even if in the grand scheme of things, going into the arts in the age of nepotism isn't a great idea, I find myself fully devoted to film in general. Wildlife documentaries would be a great thing to do. It's a great learning experience. It's something that I have wanted to do for a very, very, very long time. And I think that it's a noble pursuit. I think that it's necessary. I think that it's mandatory even. But I'm never going to stop doing what I do. I am also a biotechnologist and an ecologist. And, you know, STEM is great. STEM is delightful. I love it. I love learning new things. But once more, I am first and foremost a filmmaker. And that's never going to change. And this project working or being a learning experience in an area of opportunity has nothing to do with whether I decide to put myself in it to fully invest myself into this niche or to keep doing as much as I can for film itself. And yeah, I hope that answers the question. This is something that I am going to do until I die. They cannot get rid of me.
Yeah, there's no right or wrong answer. I'm always just curious about, I mean, here's the other thing. Like, the two of you mentioned the importance of having people involved in this that are not necessarily, you know, it's not just about the salamanders, it's about other people involved. So when I conduct an interview, I'm always curious about what motivates the people that I'm interviewing, you know, I mean, like what motivates mm-hmm. the two of you to go do these projects and, mm-hmm. you know, what your long-term goals are and what you expect to get out of it. I admire the creative process, and I'm always curious about what moves people to go on to create something. And everybody's different. Everyone has different answers. And like I said, there's no right or wrong. And I give you guys a lot of credit for taking on something that's so ambitious.
Oh, thank you very much. We really appreciate it. And, you know, if there's no risk, there's no reward.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And for anyone who's listening who wants to, I guess, be involved or donate towards the project, how would they go about doing so?
We have a GoFundMe. If you look at, I believe it, either of our Twitter handles have it. I think that it's on all my Instagram bios and everything. And of course, I can send it to you for you to put in the link for the podcast as well, if you'd like.
Sure. And if they were to wanted to find you guys on social media or other platforms to see, you know, examples of research or work, how would they be able to do that?
For me, I post most of my research on SH_herpetology on Twitter. And on Instagram, I believe that the one I use for wildlife is like Animal Chats with Simon or something. But where I post a lot of my persona is like a rocker is on Serpentine Psi. And either I'm happy to talk to people about salamanders on either. But one of my Instagrams isn't so much wildlife related as the other one.
I am on social, all of my social media handles are the same username, which is at VIVOSAUR. And yeah, people can find me on there. They are more than welcome to ask me any questions they have, whether it is about this project or anything else. I'm always happy to sit down and chat with people, especially if they have any questions about putting together a project like this, if it's something that they have been interested in and they don't know where to start. Don't worry, we didn't know either. So you are more than welcome to ask us any questions.
Well, I give you two a lot of credit. I think it's going to be a great project, and I hope you all have a lot of luck with it.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We know it's ambitious, but in my country, we have a saying, which translated is that you have to spit upwards. And it basically means that, you know, you have to be as ambitious as you can. And once the final product and once you get results on your lap, they are going to be, you know, at least somewhat what you wanted because you were as ambitious as you could. And there's not a limit. There's not a limit to how much you can want if you put in the work, you know? So it really, as long as you have the drive and as long as you do something with it, you'll be able to make it. And if you don't make it exactly as you want it to, it'll be somewhat similar and eventually you'll get there.
Well, that's a good attitude to have. That's definitely the way you get, that's definitely the way to get what you want, is to just go for it and not give up till you get it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's the, you know, if you have sand kicked in your face, get back up, never stop. And that's kind of where we are at with this, you know, with every project. You know, there's going to be setbacks, there's going to be things that, you know, make the project have to take another step, but we are very, very much go-getters in this, and we are, you know, hoping to just take this project and run with it as far as we can.
Excellent. Well, listen, everyone, I want to thank everybody for taking the time to listen. I want to thank Aura and Sai for taking the time to talk to us about, you know, the art of film and making a documentary and what they expect to get out of it. And like I said, if any of you are interested in supporting the documentary, obviously reach out and find a way to support it. And I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. I like to feature different angles of the amphibian world. And I feel like people who create things, whether it's drawing, painting, film, photography, sculpture, whatever, I think it tells a big, you know, it tells a lot of other aspects to the story. And, I think it's important that besides just husbandry and research, we talk about everything else that goes into it, because it's a pretty amazing community. And I do like to highlight people from all different walks of it. So anyway, I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. I did, and I will catch up with you again next time.